This is number 0058, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0058. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, the amazing voice actor Josh Keaton, who is the voice of Spider-Man. And he has a new video game coming out that brings together the voices of several Spider-Men.
I do have a new Spider-Man video game that has just come out, and it's called Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. It's really, really cool. It takes place in four different dimensions, and there's four different Spider-Men that have to basically work together to solve the main quest without giving out any storylines. And it's cool because they actually got voice actors who have voiced Spider-Man at some point in the character's history to voice all of these different Spider-Men. They got me, they got Dan Gilvezan from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends in the 80s, Neil Patrick Harris from the MTV show that was out in between the movies, and then Chris Barnes from the 90s show.
Peter Robinson, author of the novel Bad Boy, the latest Inspector Banks novel. It's the 19th Inspector Banks novel. Is he still learning things about the character he created?
Well, I have to do, otherwise I wouldn't be able to go on writing them. I mean, what keeps me going is finding out new things about him and, you know, having him age and change and react to things that happen in his life. So if there were no sort of progress, if there were no change in him, it would be pretty boring for me, I think.
James Billmeyer, author of Jolt, The Impending Dominance of the Electric Car, Why America Must Take Charge. Has he been dismayed with the slowness of the electric car being more dominant on the scene?
Well, you know, the technology, I've seen this in other technologies. I've been in the computer industry and the internet industry as part of those waves. What I've seen is common here is for years, these technologies, even the instant success of the computer and the instant success of internet, were really 10, 20, 30 years in the making. And this is the same thing with electric cars. So it really hasn't been frustrating. It's actually exciting right now to see we've now broken through those thresholds, and this change is impending. It's going to happen very, very quickly now that we're at this point.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0058, is Kate Houston, who writes one of the funniest blogs online. That blog is trysweettalk.com. It's about men, women, and dating. Single or not, it's one of the funniest blogs, and Kate Houston, one of North America's best online dating profile writers. Yes, online daters need to hire a profile writer. So check out the site. That's trysweettalk.com. There's lots of great stuff there waiting for you. Thank you very much, Kate, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a story that takes place in Duncansville, Pennsylvania. Police said two women who tried to rob a central Pennsylvania adult bookstore with a toy gun didn't fool the clerk, who told them to get a real gun. Authorities said 28-year-old Shannon Sharipka of Glasgow and 26-year-old Angela Crook, there's an unfortunate name, of Coldport, attempted to rob the Adult World store in Duncansville at around 1 a.m. Chiripka told police the clerk said, first, if you're going to rob someone, get a real gun. Second off, you're not getting any money. Authorities said the clerk chased away the women before police in nearby Logan Township arrested them in a van that the clerk had described. The women remain in the Blair County Jail on robbery and other charges. Meanwhile, on to Peru we go. Politics and political campaigns can be a dirty business, but I think I found a case that goes to a new low. Foes of a small-town mayor in Peru said they have dug up the skull of his late father and won't give it back unless he drops out of next month's election. Police in San Cristobal said unknown thieves unearthed the remains of Juan Vizcarra Quispe, who died in 1978. His bones were found strewn about the cemetery, but his skull is missing. Mayor Rogelio Vizcarra said he received a text message offering to return the skull if he withdraws his bid for re-election on October 3rd, but he still plans to run. San Cristobal police officer Leonardo Castro said authorities are investigating Vizcarra's political opponents. Castro said that the theft violates a law against offending the memory of the dead, which is punishable by 2 years in prison. On to Portland, Oregon. The FBI says it made an arrest in an Oregon bank robbery after the suspect posted a claim of responsibility on Facebook. Spokeswoman Beth Ann Steele said Ryan Holmesley was arrested. She says investigators filed a complaint in federal court charging Holmesley with the robbery at the Key Bank branch. Steele said Holmesley had been a hospital patient since last week and would be scheduled for a court appearance upon his release. A posting on Holmesley's Facebook page said, "I'm doing this to pay for my medical expenses. Live for today." His brother said Holmesley has a serious drug problem and is a diabetic. He was dubbed the Where's Waldo Bandit because it's based on his appearance in surveillance videos. And on to Melbourne. Speaking of online stuff, we have another Facebook story for you. A newlywed woman discovered her husband was already married when she saw his wedding pictures on Facebook. Fairfax newspaper said the woman, who is known only by the pseudonym Ms. Hugh, made the shocking find less than a month after marrying her husband, known as Mr. Ling, in February. The woman, who sought an annulment, said Ling traveled to Hong Kong to marry his former girlfriend, back in December, just weeks before his second wedding. "He had told me he went to China to visit his family," Hugh said in family court. Hugh said Ling's mother was shocked to hear about our wedding and did not know anything about it when she later told her. Ling is reportedly facing possible prosecution for bigamy, which has a maximum penalty of 5 years in jail. 5 lonely years in jail without wife number one or wife number two. Okay, moving right along, one more story in the Stuff File News portion of the program before we get to our first guest. Craig Smallwood of Hawaii is actually going to get his day in court. It may seem weird to you and me, but Judge Alan Kay declined to dismiss the bizarre lawsuit and set a date for trial. Mr. Smallwood is suing the makers of the online virtual world game Lineage 2 because he says they failed to warn him that he would become so addicted to playing it that he would be, quote, unable to function independently in usual daily activities such as getting up, getting dressed, bathing, or communicating with family and friends, unquote. Yeah, Smallwood says his addiction became so intense he spent over 20,000 hours over 5 years playing the game. Okay, a quick calculation to consider here. There are only 8,760 hours in a year. That's 43,800 in 5 years. So if our whacked-out friend spent over 20,000 hours over 5 years playing that game, that works out to about 12 hours a day, every day, for 5 years. And somehow this is the game maker's fault? I don't think so. Well, speaking of video games, let's get to our first guest, shall we? On the line with us right now is Josh Keaton, a very busy actor in California these days, but you would best know him for his voice. He is the voice of the animated series Spider-Man, plus he has a Spider-Man video game coming out. He's also part of the new Transformers animated series, and he has a new Cartoon Network movie called Fire Breather. Plus there are other projects which even he can't talk about right now. But thanks to Skype Communications, he's here to talk to us about some of the work that he's doing. Hi, Josh. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Peter. How about yourself?
I'm fine. Nice to have you back on the program with us.
It's great to be back.
Now, I spoke to you on the old radio show, and you were in the midst of doing Spider-Man. Are you still doing the Spider-Man weekly series, or has that come to an end?
No, unfortunately, Spectacular Spider-Man has come to an end. But I do have a new Spider-Man video game that has just come out, and it's called Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. It's really, really cool. It takes place in four different universes, and four different dimensions, excuse me. And there's four different Spider-Men that have to basically work together to solve the main quest without giving out any storylines. And it's cool because they actually got voice actors who have voiced Spider-Man at some point in the character's history to voice all of these different Spider-Men. So they got me, they got Dan Gilvezan from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends in the 80s, Neil Patrick Harris from the MTV show that was out in between the movies, and then Chris Barnes from the 90s show.
Wow, so it's almost like a Spider-Man convention.
Yes, it is. Big reunion.
Now, as I assume with most voice work, even though you mention all these cast of characters and other actors, you got to do this by yourself.
Yeah, the video game was everybody was just one-on-one. I didn't actually get to see the other actors that were playing Spider-Man until, me, Dan, and Chris Barnes, or should I say Chris Barnes, Dan, and I, were all in the same studio to do the trailer for the game. And so then I actually got to sit down with three generations of Spidey.
Wow.
And just and kick it. It was kind of neat.
Now let's talk about one of the other projects that we mentioned earlier, I mentioned in the introduction, and that is the Transformers animated series?
Yes, Transformers animated series. It's called Transformers Prime. It's going to be on a new network called The Hub. And The Hub is Hasbro. It's like a co-venture between Hasbro and Discovery Kids. So there's going to be a bunch of new shows and a bunch of relaunches of old classic shows, shows that I grew up with. There's going to be a new G.I. Joe and, as you know, a new Transformers. There's going to be Pound Puppies and My Little Pony and all kinds of stuff. I'm going to have to get another bowl of cereal and sit in front of the TV on Saturdays, or probably every day. I'm sure they're showing stuff all the time.
So what will you be playing on the Transformers animated series?
I play Jack Darby on the show, and I am one of the humans in the show. And the show is more bot-centric than human-centric. The humans are there in more of a supportive capacity, but it's really a show about the bots, and I think that's where it kind of differs a little bit from the movies.
And I also touched on Cartoon Network movie that you're doing called Fire Breather?
Yes. Fire Breather is based on a comic series, and it's going to be coming out, I think, later this year. I'm not exactly sure. They haven't given me a date, but it looks really cool. It's Cartoon Network's first CG film, and it's going to be premiering on their network.
Now, the last time I talked to you on the old radio show, one of the other things we touched on was the fact that besides all the voice work you do, and also work you do in front of the camera, which you've done...
Yes.
You also sing.
Yes.
So are you still doing that?
And you gave me my first on-air as a solo artist radio play, and I will always remember you for that. That was awesome.
That was my pleasure.
Yes, I am still singing. It's kind of been put a little bit on the back burner just because voiceover and animation especially, because in addition to all that stuff that we just talked about, there's like a whole other... animated show that I just started doing, but I can't even give any details on that yet. But so singing I've had to kind of put on the back burner for a little bit, but I'm able to do it in more of a creative capacity now, where I'm trying not to put the pressure on myself to get the album finished. I'm just going at it and doing it when I have a chance, and it's been working out. I really am looking at having something finished by the end of the year, and this is probably the eighth year that I've said that, but it's really going to happen this time.
So I know you enjoy all the things you do, but as an artist, what one thing gives you the most passion? Is it the voice work? Is it the singing?
I think more than anything, it's just telling stories, and that kind of spans many forms of media, and really that's what excites me about everything that I do. I mean, whether it's songwriting, you're telling a story through poetry and melody, or whether you're voicing a character on a show or being in front of the camera, it all serves the same purpose, and that's what I get my passion from. That's what I love to do.
You've also worked, as I said, before the cameras as an actor. You've done things like, what is it, Bones, ER, Boston Public, Touched by an Angel, the list goes on and on and on. Do you enjoy doing that or prefer doing that as well, or would like to do more of that? Or
Definitely the latter. I would definitely love to do more of it. But again, just like singing, it's one of those things where voiceover got so I got so busy doing so many things so quickly that that a lot of things just had focus shifted away from them. But yeah, I definitely would like to do more on camera. It's where I started, and I definitely don't want to give that up.
How did the voiceover stuff start for you?
It actually kind of start, well, not kind of, it started as an outgrowth of my on-camera career. I had this agent that sent me out on a couple of voiceover jobs because they were for animated series. And a lot of times when they're casting animated shows, they don't really just turn to the voiceover pool of talent. They tend to call every agent and have everybody submit for the parts. And so that's how I really got my first couple of jobs. I was in Peter Pan and the Pirates. That was a show on Fox Kids, and Tim Curry was not Peter Pan. That would have been really, really surreal. Tim Curry was Captain Hook, and it was a great show. I was one of the Lost Boys. After that, I did Back to the Future, the animated series, and I played one of Doc Brown's kids, Jules. He was the brainy one. And I got that job because I was probably the only kid that could pronounce all of the technical jargon that I had to say, and I had to kind of rattle off this little monologue about what I was doing, and yeah, so that's pretty much how it started. And it wasn't until I did Hercules, the Disney animated movie, that I was approached by a completely just focused voiceover agent that did nothing but voiceovers, and that's pretty much where that chapter began.
Well, when you started doing voice work, it is a different part of your brain. You're not as, you're vocally more expressive and facially less expressive, I guess, than you would be if you were on stage or on screen. Is it different as an actor to do that for you?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm facially less expressive. If you see me in the booth, I'm
actually
going,
yeah, the other
nuts,
way I should, yeah, say, yeah.
But yeah, it definitely is a different mode that you have to get yourself in, because you do have to carry so much more of the story just through your voice. They're not going to see all the antics that you're doing in there to get your voice where it needs to be. So that's definitely something you have to think about. But at the same time, it's still acting. You still have to make the same choices and do that same preparation and scene breakdowns, because that's really what's going to give the characters depth. It's one thing to do a silly voice, but it's another thing to make that silly voice a three-dimensional character that people are going to care about.
Is there anything you haven't done that you really want to do? Besides get that album out after 8 years.
Yeah, that would probably be number one on the priority list that I haven't done. Aside from that, I really want to travel more. All of this stuff has been awesome, but I definitely would love to get away for a little bit and do a little bit of traveling. Like to go to South America and go to Machu Picchu. I'm actually half Peruvian, and the last time that I was in Peru, I was about 2 years old, so I really don't even remember a thing. And yeah, I would love to check out Machu Picchu and go do those hikes and see some of that.
But as an actor, is there anything you haven't done?
As an actor, yes. I would definitely like to do more film work. I've done independent films. I've done short films. But that big feature, big screen, bigger parts, that still eluded me. And that's something that's definitely in my plan.
Well, you've got a lot of things we can look forward to. As you mentioned, the Spider-Man video game coming out, the Transformers animated series, the Cartoon Network movie called Fire Breather, and the stuff that you can't talk about. But
yes,
we'll keep an eye out for that as well. And when you're not doing all that and dreaming about going to Machu Picchu, you are also playing Project Gotham, I understand, a lot on Xbox. So.
Yes, yeah. And I just started playing Blur, which is actually surprisingly really, really fun.
Okay. I thank you very, very much, Josh, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Actor and singer Josh Keaton. You can check out his website at joshkeaton.com. And of course, you can find the link on my website at thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Peter Robinson, the author of Bad Boy, the latest Inspector Banks novel. And we'll also meet the author of Jolt, the impending dominance of the electric car. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day and lots more stuff right here, right now. So let's get to it. You know, they may have only been trying to reignite the fires of a lost love, but in Fort Myers, Florida, police officer Jason Moore and dispatchers Jolene Jeffrey and Michael Grimmett have all been fired after an internal affairs investigation showed they faked a suspicious person's call. The story is, Moore requested the fake call so his police officer ex-girlfriend would show up at the Edison Mall and confront him. Moore said he did it because the two had broken up and he felt it was the only way he could get to talk to her and confess his love. The dispatchers agreed with the plot, but instead of sending it to Moore's ex, the report went out to multiple units, and several officers responded thinking the call was real. Moore later confessed to his sergeant, and all three were fired for knowingly going along with the false information. No word on whether the girlfriend is taking him back, but we're going to go with the fact that probably it's going to be no. You know, the road to being fired is often filled with good intentions. Okay, a 47-year-old man identified only by his last name of Miller is facing indecent exposure charges after police say he was found without pants on, taking pictures of himself in a parking lot of Sears at the Galleria Mall in Rock Hill, South Carolina. When officers asked why he wasn't wearing pants, he said, "I was trying to get a tan." On Miller's cell phone, in the seat next to him, officers found pictures he had taken of the lower half of his body. The best part of this story is Mr. Miller lives on Naked Creek Road. Well, you are where you live, I guess. Okay, in Grants Pass, Oregon, 37-year-old Erica Faye Anderson at least had her priorities straight. She made sure she robbed the bank before it was time to pick up her kids from school. Police say Anderson and 19-year-old Joshua Kemp Dieter Tsiu robbed the Umpqua Bank at around 2:15 p.m. and then went to pick up her two daughters from Highland Elementary School. She allegedly presented tellers with a demand note and then fled with the cash. However, they say an alert citizen turned in a description and plates of the suspicious vehicle that investigators connected to Anderson. She and Tsiu were both arrested and faced charges of robbery in the second degree and theft in the first degree. Oh, and the two daughters were turned over to the Department of Human Services. Yes, it'll be a while before she sees those kids again. Now, here's a question. If Google doesn't recognize your city, does it really even exist? Sunrise, Florida is home to 90,000 people, has one of America's biggest malls, a National Hockey League team, and as the city's mayor boasts, the first IKEA store in the state. But for at least a month this summer, Google's computers lost Sunrise, Florida. People who searched Google Maps for the city were directed instead to Sarasota, Florida, some 200 miles away. No Sunrise business or addresses or phone numbers showed up. Even City Hall and other public entities were strangely absent. Google says it has fixed the technical error, but that didn't happen until after much public outcry. Sunrise Mayor Mike Ryan said this is the third time Google has dropped his city off the digital map, which he says is unacceptable. He said, "Holy cow, it felt like a bizarre novel that all of a sudden we disappeared. We woke up one morning and we didn't exist in the ether world." And the locals are not laughing. Local business owners complain they lost revenue because people searching for certain types of businesses in town would skip right past them. Not good. Not good at all. Still with some other online news, New Delhi, India is famous for its horrendous traffic jams and unruly drivers, aggressive rule breakers who barrel through red lights, ignore crosswalks, and veer into bicycle or bus lanes to find open routes. Well, police are cracking down on those lawbreakers with a little help from Facebook. Traffic cops started a Facebook page 2 months ago, and almost immediately residents became digital informants, posting photos of their fellow drivers violating traffic laws. So far, more than 17,000 people have become fans of the page and posted almost 3,000 photographs and dozens of videos. Using the pictures, the Delhi Traffic Police have issued 665 tickets using the license plate numbers shown in the photos to track the vehicle owners down. A bit of irony, though, you actually aren't supposed to photograph or videotape bad drivers if you're driving yourself. Using a cell phone camera while driving is itself against the law. A police spokesperson said, "We advise while you are driving not to take a photo of a fellow driver who is breaking traffic laws." Ain't social media grand? Yes, brave new world out there. Okay, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Peter Robinson is the author of the wildly successful Inspector Banks mysteries. His latest one is the 19th Inspector Banks novel. It's called Bad Boy. Peter Robinson joins us on the line right now. Hello, Peter.
Hello there.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You have churned out 19 of these now. When you first started writing them, did you ever think you'd be at this point?
Well, when I first started writing, I'd written one or two. I thought there may be a time when I'd be at the point of having written 19, but not necessarily featuring the same character.
In writing these novels over the years, do you yourself discover things about Inspector Banks that you didn't know?
Well, I have to do, otherwise I wouldn't be able to go on writing them. I mean, what keeps me going is finding out new things about him and, you know, having him age and change and react to things that happen in his life. So if there were no sort of progress, if there were no change in him, it would be pretty boring for me, I think.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because there are successful novels out there and characterizations over the years of different characters that don't age. Was this a conscious effort on your part when you started writing these?
Not really, no. I mean, if you think of someone like Hercule Poirot, who must have been about 180 by the end of the last book, I can see what you mean. Even Sherlock Holmes, although he does retire and does get killed at one point, doesn't really age that much. But, you know, those characters really existed as sort of mental processes to solve puzzles. I'm really interested in, you know, someone living in a real world and reacting to that world and you know, going through the things that people go through in life. So it just seemed a very natural choice. It wasn't something I had to sit and consider whether I wanted to do or not.
So tell us about the latest book, which is entitled Bad Boy.
Well, Bad Boy is a bad boy, and you know, he's one of these guys that girls seem to drool over, that he's wrong. You know, he's a wrong'un, as they used to say in Yorkshire. And it actually came from an article I read in the Guardian Weekly about parents who turned in their kids to the police if they found drugs or, in some cases, a gun in the kids' room. And what a terrible dilemma this was, and, you know, how they must have been at the end of their tether at the time. And I thought I'd like to start with a scene like that and have it go, have the collection of the gun go wrong. So that's how it begins, and, you know, very much with sort of detailed police procedure, and then step by step everything starts to fall apart and the story shoots off.
You set this, of course, it's set in the UK, or the character of Inspector Banks is set in the UK. You are originally from the UK, but have spent many, many years living in Canada, in Toronto. Do you find that you have to constantly immerse yourself in things UK to continue writing Inspector Banks, or is it just from your vivid imagination and memory of having grown up in the area?
Well, it's a bit of everything, really, and these days I have a flat in Richmond, North Yorkshire, which is very close to the place that East Vale and the books is based on. So, you know, I go there maybe a couple of times a year for longer periods. So I kind of immerse myself in it, you know, a lot more than I used to do. I used to visit for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, every now and then, and probably would do more research. But now, in a sense, I get the experience of living there for a month or two and just absorb things. So I'm not so conscious about you know, going there on a fishing expedition or something.
In creating this character, Inspector Banks, in writing him for so long, in making him so popular, how is it received by actual British police?
Well, they... when I ask them what they think of it, I mean, I have a few friends who are in the police force, and I say, well, look, you know, did I get this bit right? Did I get the procedure right and everything? They say, oh, I don't know, I didn't really pay attention to that. But they like the story, and we like Banks. He thinks like we do. So that's probably as good as you can get. Occasionally I'll get an email from a police detective saying, you mentioned this, we probably wouldn't do this, you know, we'd do this. And I always email back and say, thanks, that's great. Maybe in future, if I have a question, you'd help answer it for me. So they're very helpful.
Recently, I understand, your character of Inspector Banks has been turned into a television pilot in the UK. Is that correct?
Yes, it's on next Monday, actually. Yeah.
Wow. So how does it feel to see your character lifted off the page and turned into a flesh and blood character on television? And is it what you saw in your mind's eye when you wrote it?
Oh, no, it could never be that. I mean, people, especially readers, get very attached and very possessive about the characters, and they can't see an actor playing it, and, you know, you just say, oh, it won't work. Well, of course it won't. I mean, if you have a very strong idea of what everyone looks like and how the story goes as it goes in the book, you're never going to reproduce that on television. So I just decided, having read so many books and watched so many TV programs over the years, I wasn't even going to think in those lines. So I watched it as something different, and, you know, I managed to split myself off from it and watch it almost as if it was something by someone else, which it was, really, because they changed the story a bit, and, you know, they were all actors playing the characters who didn't look like the way I imagined the characters, but it didn't bother me. I mean, that's what television is.
Okay, I'm assuming you'll continue to write Inspector Banks stories.
I will, yeah.
So the question begs to be asked now. Now that it's been serialized in a television show, and as you say, no one envisions the way the character acts, looks, talks, so on and so forth, does the television version now, are you worried about it permeating your future writing?
I was at first, you know, because I've heard it's happened with people, but no, I think because I managed to, I mean, I've met the actor who plays Banks as himself, and you know, we sort of had dinners and lunches together, and we get along fine. And when I watch him playing Banks, I'm aware that he's acting. He's not the person I know when I go out for lunch with or whatever. So I managed to sort of cut myself off from it in that sense. It is something different, and it's not going to impinge on my mind when I'm writing. At least I hope not. I mean, I haven't tried to write any Banks since I've seen it.
Is it, over the years, easier or more difficult to write Inspector Banks? And the other side of that coin is, do you ever turn off? Like, if you're traveling, if you see a situation, it's like, oh, this is something for Inspector Banks?
Well, it gets more difficult because you use up material with each book. And that's why, you know, I need to develop him and take him a little further every time. So, yeah, I mean, it's not that it's so difficult to find a story. There are always enough bits and pieces happening here and there in the world that you can cobble something of a plot together. But you've got to keep the character moving and changing. And, I'm still quite happy writing about him, even though it's harder. And I didn't expect it would get easier. But I do occasionally need to escape and to do something different, which I'm actually doing at the moment. The next book won't be a Banks book.
With the popularity of the character over the years, and you've had the opportunity, I'm sure, to meet many fans, at the very least at book signings and the like, do you ever hear from fans saying, oh, this is what I'd like Inspector Banks to be or not be? And does that ever come into play when you're writing a future story?
No, I do hear things. I mean, occasionally people try to tell me what to write, but I ignore them. I figure I'm the writer, so I should be the one who's making those decisions. I mean, it's not an arrogant thing, because I try to write the kind of book that I would like to read, and I assume that if I would like to read it, then lots of other people might too, because I have, you know, quite broad taste in fiction. I read a lot of crime fiction, I read literary fiction, I read, you know, all kinds of stuff. I just love reading stuff. So I assume if I write the sort of book that pleases me, then it will also please others.
Do you know, when you write an Inspector Banks story, as you start, how it all fleshes out? Are you one of those writers who has the idea, the story, the plot line, set up throughout the story, and then you write it? Or, again, do you learn things about the story as you write it?
Yeah, it's very much as I go, by the seat of my pants. I don't plan it out. Sometimes I wish I did, because I do get stuck occasionally. But, you know, there again, it's fun trying to get yourself out of a corner you've painted yourself in or written yourself into. I think that if it's fresh for me and a sort of journey of discovery for me, then it will be to some extent for the reader too. And if I were just joining the dots, I worry that it might show. Although I know many good writers who do extensive outlines and write terrific books. You just have to find the way that works best for you.
How much of you is in Inspector Banks, or vice versa?
Oh, well, the music, I think. I mean, that's mostly it. You know, he's a huge music fan, as I am, and has very broad musical tastes. And it would be difficult to write about that if I didn't have the same sort of enthusiasm that he does. Beyond that, though, not a lot. I mean, I couldn't do his job. I mean, you'd have to deal with criminals and blood and stuff like that, and I don't like blood. He couldn't do my job because he doesn't like writing reports. So, you know, we managed to maintain that difference.
Well, the latest book is entitled Bad Boy. It's the latest Inspector Banks novel, the 19th in the series of books. It's written by Peter Robinson. And Peter, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Okay, thank you.
Peter Robinson, author of Bad Boy, an Inspector Banks mystery. Check out Peter's website at inspectorbanks.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is number 0058, and you'll find links to Peter's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorico Jones. There's an old saying that necessity is the mother of invention. How true that is. The ability of so many American inventors to meet the needs of a growing country has always been one of our greatest strengths. Since the days of Ben Franklin, we've usually been blessed with laws that nurture inventors and protect the time and resources they invest in their hard work. But America's prominence as a land of invention can no longer be taken for granted. The president of one of the most respected high-tech companies in America recently predicted that, and I quote, "the next big thing will not be invented here." That's a very disturbing warning, but the chief executive officer of Intel Corporation believes America is losing its edge. And he says one of the reasons is that our legal environment has become hostile to business. Let's be fair. When a respected leader in an industry that has led our nation in creating jobs says lawsuits are smothering invention, it's time to reinvent our legal system. Learn more. Go to my website at bobdoricojones.com.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're in the home stretch here on The Stuff File program. Still to come, we'll talk to the author of Jolt, The Impending Dominance of the Electric Car. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But before we get to that, one more Stuff File story to share with you in the news section of the program. And this one takes us to Italy. An Italian priest is pleading with churchgoers to help fill the pews at poorly attended funerals. The Reverend Marcello Colcelli wrote to members of his Arezzo church asking them to join his Company of the Departed to fill seats at funerals that are often poorly attended or even completely empty. Colcelli wrote, he is encountering many services attended by, quote, only a few relatives and acquaintances. And sometimes he found himself alone with the deceased. Ooh, that's kind of creepy. I often have to do everything on my own, the readings, the rites, even the mourning, Colcetti wrote in the letter, which was printed in Magazine Daily in Italy. I could carry on like this, but I asked myself, where's the community? The cleric said he was drafting a document for possible members of the Company of the Departed, including an obligation, when possible, to take part in funerals, guaranteeing a minimum funeral service, including readings, offerings, and incense. Well, it's not like the dead guy knows what's going on, or not going on. Relax, Padre. Relax. You know, I don't mean to be cold here, like the guy in the casket, but sometimes some people just don't deserve a big send-off. On the other hand, to even be colder, as the old saying goes, sometimes you give the audience what they want, and they'll turn out in droves. So it all depends on how much the person in the box was liked. But I digress. Time for our next guest, our final guest on this edition of the Stuff File program. On the line with us right now is James Billmeyer. He is the author of Jolt, The Impending Dominance of the Electric Car, Why America Must Take Charge. How you doing, James?
I'm doing very well, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. The North American market certainly has dominance or propensity towards oil, and you say that dominance has to break. Now, you've been in the business of working on electric cars for years. Do you sometimes get frustrated that we haven't moved along faster?
Well, you know, the technology, I've seen this in other technologies. I've been in the computer industry and the internet industry as part of those waves. And what I've seen is common here is for years, these technologies, even the instant success of the computer and the instant success of internet, were really 10, 20, 30 years in the making. And this is the same thing with electric cars. So it really hasn't been frustrating. It's actually exciting right now to see we've now broken through those thresholds. And this change is impending. It's going to happen very, very quickly now that we're at this point.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I always got the impression that part of the problem was the lack of desire to get off fossil fuels.
You know, I'm not sure that's been the case. I think that the alternatives have been too expensive or too difficult for users, and we're at a point now with the battery technology and electric motor technology that users are going to have a blast driving these cars, and from a cost standpoint, it's going to be cheaper. So that's the inflection point we're sitting on right now.
Now, going back to, I guess, the late 50s, America was in a space race with the Soviet Union trying to get to the moon. Is this a similar analogy with now America in a race to get the electric car out before other big competitors? I believe China is a big player in this.
Yeah, we have a chapter in Jolt, the book called Sputnik Redux, Redo, basically. It's all about how when Sputnik, launched by the Soviet Union in 1957, really woke up America and realized we had a competitor technologically and militarily. And the same thing is happening in China now. It's just a little bit less visible. They have chosen the electric car and the associated technologies for infrastructure and other clean tech ways of making energy. The point at which they move up from being a manufacturer to being an innovator and a manufacturer, and really America has been the innovator in every major technological movement for the last 100-plus years, starting with the steam engine, so probably a couple hundred years. And it's just not going to be a good thing for America if we sit back and let China not just take manufacturing away from us, but let them take the innovation that we really should lead.
So is that competition helping? I'm often reminded of the fact that the fastest long-distance runner is only marginally better than his closest competitor.
You know, it's one of those things that we call it, co-opetition. So it is good, and it's good for the planet and good for a lot of other things to have China working hard to do those kind of things in the clean tech space. It's good for their economy, their environment. What I don't like coming out of China is sort of the unfair competition, them using their markets and requiring them to basically buy their clean tech stuff while America tries and other foreign countries try to sell into their country and limiting that. And just a recent story about how if American or other foreign companies want to sell their automobiles, their electric automobiles into China, China is requiring that they hand over the intellectual property. So there's some things that, yes, are very positive about China being involved in this race. It makes us better. But there's some things that I don't like as well. And I think as long as America really wakes up around this, JOLT is about a program that really pushes the country in this direction because it solves so many of our problems from an economic standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, from a military standpoint, these kinds of national security issues, getting off of foreign oil and controlling our own destiny relative to our technology is very important.
The road has been long in this situation, and you said earlier that it's quickly ramping up because of technology. Realistically, how fast, what kind of timetable are we talking about before the electric car, as you see it, is a commonplace, the situation in North America?
Well, you're going to start seeing a lot of them actually this year. Both Nissan and Chevrolet with the Chevy Volt and the Nissan Leaf are introducing cars that will be delivered this calendar year, so just in the next couple of months. And from there, and both of those companies, by the way, are completely sold out for their first initial run of these cars, and they both announced plans to dramatically ramp up the manufacturing capacity. And by the way, Nissan is manufacturing those cars in Tennessee, so right in the United States. I think you're going to see it happen quite quickly. The JOLT program calls for 100 million electric or plug-in vehicles on the road by the end of this decade. It's kind of our moonshot, our John Kennedy, we'll get to the moon and return within this decade. We should be trying to make, that would be about 40% of our cars being electric by the end of the decade. And I think when 2020 comes around, the technology will be so clear and so obvious and so much less expensive than the gas alternative that everybody will be buying electric cars starting in 2020.
How much is involved here as far as innovation is concerned as opposed to legislation? In other words, do legislators play a role in this in pushing us faster towards electricity than maybe we would like to go?
Yes, and in a couple of ways. Right now, legislation as a result of our military spending and direct tax credits, et cetera, to oil companies are offsetting the true cost of gas by at least $2 to $3. So that legislation that's occurred way in the past has made an unlevel playing field. One of the things JOLT calls for is let's level that playing field so that capitalism can actually, you know, have a fair shot here at having the right technologies being embraced. And so right now there's a $7,500 tax credit when you buy a electric car with a certain size battery. And what the book is calling for is to make that an instant rebate. And several other things. There's actually a 10-point program in the book, or you can see it on the website as well at jolttheBook.org, that we call for in certain areas of legislation. But the biggest and best thing we can do is have consumers signal demand. So what we have is we're looking for consumers to pledge that their next new car, if they're going to buy a new car, make sure it has a plug in it. And that will drive the behavior as it has for the computer and the internet and all the big technological waves that have gone in the past. That will, consumer demand will drive this more than anything else we could do.
Is there any concern, at least with the current technology, that transferring from fossil fuels to electric cars, as you say, making sure that each new car has a plug in it, does it not transfer some of the burden to our electrical grid?
You know, that's one of the great myths, and it's a great question, Peter. Our grid has so much excess capacity. In the evening time frames when most cars will be charged at home, we have the capacity to house 180 million cars without using any new or creating any new electrical generation. That's a study from the Pacific Northwest National Labs that's quoted frequently. If you want to charge during peak hours, we can. Every 10 million cars that we put onto the grid only impacts the grid less than 1%. I've talked to, and it's outlined in the book, a lot of the people who are responsible for delivering energy and power and electricity to American homes, and the guys who know about this stuff are not worried about the grid tipping over. These are the same kinds of concerns we heard during the computer days and the internet days. You know, the cries that, oh, the internet's going to come to a halt and this whole thing's going to tip over. And it just never happens because capitalistic behavior causes companies to go do the right things.
The book is called Jolt, The Impending Dominance of the Electric Car, Why America Must Take Charge. Primarily, and we just have about a minute, who do you believe your target audience is for this book? Just the general consumer? Or the business thinker out there?
Well, it is a business book largely, and it talks about national security. So it's kind of a combination between a business and a political book. And we think people who are interested in those topics are the ones that are going to be the first purchasers of the book. But it's also about the generic consumer. So there's a lot of people who just have an interest in this area who we think would enjoy reading this.
And you mentioned the website, which is jolttheBook.org, correct?
That's correct. And you can get additional information, a lot of different links and whatnot about electric cars, this technology, national security, and you can take the pledge there. You can commit to making certain that if you're about to buy or in the future going to buy a new car, that it's going to have a plug in it.
I thank you very much, James, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, it was my pleasure.
James Billmeyer, author of Jolt, The Impending Dominance of the Electric Car, Why America Must Take Charge. You can check out his website at jolttheBook.org. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to go to the What's On page, and you'll find links to James's book, plus links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order the book directly. Just make sure you go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0058. And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program, but we have one more item to go, and you all know what that is. Yes, it's time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Terrence Mitchell of Waterloo, Iowa, has definitely earned himself a place in the race for stupidest man on the planet. He allegedly tried to shoplift surveillance equipment from an electronics store, but he was arrested after being identified on the store's own video monitors. We can only assume it never occurred to Mr. Mitchell that stores that sell surveillance equipment might operate surveillance cameras. And for that reason, and that reason alone, Mr. Terrence Mitchell of Waterloo, Iowa, you, sir, are an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0058. Hope you've enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0058. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder, or Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDX Radio, Radio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJmedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier China Airlines for their long-haul dynasty flights, and over the air on World FM 88.2 in New Zealand and Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.